everyone, and welcome to another episode of Pulse. This week, we will be pivoting back to our book club, and this week we will be discussing American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey, that was published by Shane Bauer. Before we get into the details of the book today, I would like to make sure that we can introduce who we have speaking with us today. So my name is Ashley Bender. I'm the Digital Communications Associate for Oklahomans for Criminal Justice Reform. And just in line with our last book club, I have here with me today, Michael and Evita, if you guys would like to give a quick couple words.
Hey, everyone. I'm excited to be here.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me again, Ashley.
Perfect. So let's get into this book. This book is a nonfiction book that was published in 2018 by the American journalist Shane Bauer. This genre of journalism is proactive rather than reactive, in that the journalist assumes an identity in order to get a first-person perspective into the subject matter. For his efforts, Bauer won the Helen Bernstein Book Award for Excellence in Journalism and the Robert F. Kennedy Book Award for Outstanding Journalism in Human Rights and Social Justice. Similarly, in line to last week, we would like to give a trigger warning. Again, the things that I'm about to warn you about, we will not go into in this podcast, but we always do want to be wary in case you yourself decide to go read these materials on your own, which we still do recommend. This book dives into very sensitive content, including suicide and abuse, and it has very strong language when it comes to racial inequities and the treatment, especially in our history in the United States, of people of color. The summary, in quick, of the book is that Shane Bauer is an investigative reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. He decides he wants to dig into American prison for profit system. He was imprisoned in Iran Evin Prison for over 2 years. And Bauer's interest leads him to the Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA, which is a very common and one of the largest private prison contractors in the country. After some initial trepidation, Bauer applies for a job as a correctional officer and is hired by Louisiana's Wynn Prison at $9 an hour. He goes through 4 weeks of training, during which time he learns about CCA policy, situations to avoid, the importance of maintaining profitability, and how to handle life-threatening situations by saving oneself and letting the incarcerated fight it out. One instructor he encounters tells the cadets not to bother trying to break up fights between prisoners because the guards aren't getting paid enough for that. In fact, it quotes, "So if them fools want to cut each other, well, happy cutting." The instructor also reassures the guards in training that he'll have their backs no matter what. He quotes, "If you are an officer and you do something 100% wrong, I'm going to take your side right on the spot." Bauer overall finds the staff very cynical, uncaring, and have low morale. He documents dozens of stabbings, scores of use of force incidents, far more than at comparable state-run units, cell doors that can be opened by inmates, atrocious medical care, and a seemingly preventable inmate suicide. So now that we've got such a fun, pretty picture to start this off with, right off the bat, this environment and these kind of words and even these stories, I mean, off the top of my own head, I know that there were 3 murders in a 10-month span from October of 2014 to August of 2015 at the Davis Correctional Facility here in Oklahoma. And after that, in 2017, there were 2 murders at Oklahoma State Correctional Facility and North Fork Facility. In more recent events, 6 people were stabbed at Lawton Correctional Facility on September 1st, but this was only one of actually 6 incidents that all happened within the same days, causing the Oklahoma Department of Corrections Director Scott Crow to actually order a lockdown for weeks. And then as soon as that lockdown ended, there was another lockdown because in October of the same year, Oklahoma County Jail started investigating a stabbing that left an inmate with 30 stab wounds and multiple bite wounds as well. But are these just particularly violent places, prisons, or is this across the board?
Well, for people in the know, this has been pretty well established in Oklahoma. There was a report in 2017 by the Bureau of Justice Statistics that called Oklahoma prisons the deadliest in the nation. It found that from 2001 to 2014, Oklahoma had the nation's 2nd highest prison homicide rate, with more than double the national average. Oklahoma had a rate of 13 killings per 100,000 inmates, state and federal, and was second only to Maine, a state that had a rate of 14 killings per 100,000 inmates. So Oklahoma's overall annual prison mortality rate, including all prison deaths, natural, accidental, and intentional homicide, was 324 per 100,000 inmates, which is tied with Mississippi for the sixth highest in the nation. The national average was 255 deaths per 100,000. The study also showed that Oklahoma had an accidental death rate of 8 per 100,000 inmates, which is triple the national average and second only to Alaska, which had unreliable data due to too small of a sample size. So this report lends further support to the notion that Oklahoma prisons are overcrowded, understaffed, and underfunded. And also, this is not just a prison problem, but a jail one as well. So 148 inmates died at the 11 largest jails in Oklahoma from 2009 to 2019. And that's a rate of 2.16 deaths per 1,000 inmates. And this is well above the national average of 1.46 deaths. And the Oklahoma County Detention Center is at an absolutely terrifying 4.77 deaths per 1,000 people.
So with this, we can see why this creates an environment of fear for all parties, for the prisoners and for the individuals, I should say, that are in these facilities, but also for the correctional officers. The issue that Bauer brings up is what happens when you don't fall in line with this attitude of not just fear, but aggression. And that seems to be the attitude that all the correctional officers have. It leaves you feeling isolated. He finds his progressive leanings in the fact that he tried to empathize with some of the inmates. He began to fear that they were taking advantage of his kindness. And this is in contrast to the other officers who were shamelessly admitting that they trained bloodhounds by using actual inmates and that they beat inmates outside of camera's view. They bragged about routinely failing to perform the most basic elements of their job. And Evita, when we were speaking about the Just Mercy episode, you helped us to tie how proximity and your relation to environments can change your outcome and your experience. And proximity finds itself again in this book. After spending more time as a correctional officer, personal taunts begin to rile him, paranoia creeps in, and he becomes harsher with inmates who then don't trust him, then causing him not to trust them. And furthermore, as his personality grows more aggressive and less accommodating, and he begins to crave this adrenaline rush of confrontation, he quits. But how does this proximity, this environment, how do you think that that relates to real life and in real time?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we have these plantation-like prisons where you have to embrace your depravity in order to survive. And we call them penitentiaries, where penance, what comes from penance, and ultimately you're supposed to come out reformed and rehabilitated, but you can't do that if you are trying to survive in a deplorable, inhumane condition. And so you adapt, you have to adapt in order to survive. And so you can't expect to put somebody in an environment where they have to embrace depravity and expect them to not conform or to come out with less than their humanity intact. You can't expect them to come out better than they went in. I have to take a departure point here and just be honest that this was a very difficult book for me. When I first encountered it, I have to say that I found it fascinating that someone would actually go undercover and actually be able to pull it off and like pull back the curtain for the world to see what was really taking place in our prison system. Because so much of what we know of prisons and our history of prisons has come to us through the filter of TV and TV executives and what's palatable for the American public, right? But as I got into the book, I found myself deeply disturbed. You know, the author jumps from period to period through history, showing a very clear line between America's cattle slavery, our 1880s post-slavery plantation-like imprisonment, contemporary leasing program system, and the current mass incarceration system. And I found myself being physically affected by what I was hearing. Like I found my body tensing up. I wanted to turn away from the content. And it wasn't because I, you know, don't know that prisons are horrible and that mass incarceration is going on or anything like that. But I was not prepared for the rawness, and that maybe that's what it is. I had not prepared myself, and especially as a Black American, to encounter the rawness of the content. And, you know, part of my luxury is that I can turn away, retreat to my cushiony life and not have to listen to what's going on in prisons. For people that are still in the system, that are in the system and they're living through it, they can't turn away. They don't have that luxury. They have to live through it. And if it affected me and just by listening, hearing it, I can't imagine how it affects people that have to live through it and survive through an environment like that. Realistically, we have to completely rethink our prison system, because there's no way, if we truly want to rehabilitate people, we want to make people whole, then we can't do it by putting them into slavery-like conditions, into a place where we would not even put our animals. We're treating people worse than we would treat our animals. You have to expect that if you put someone in a system like that, whether they are prison guard, whether they are in prison, that they're going to conform to that type of environment, to that type of culture and way of living. And it's very hard once they get out to regain some of their humanity.
It's disgusting that you could just draw a straight line from like slavery to jails. Like, right? It's terrible.
Right. I mean, it's like the for-profit off of we're talking about in this book, where it's, and in reality, disproportionately Black bodies. And I think he was saying that 70% Black in the prison he was in, but just like Black bodies for profit. He even speaks about time, like using their urine and taking that and selling it. I mean, just, you know, leasing people out. Even we go back to the Black codes where people could become indentured servants again, but really wasn't like indentured servitude that we know of from pre-American times. It was deeply disturbing, and it took me to a period that I wasn't prepared to go to. In 2014, he went through this experience. In 2014, I mean, I honestly was thinking, if I had not known that he was 1950s or 1800s, this was 2014. That's just a few years ago.
When you and I spoke about this before, I was saying he's blunt, but I don't even know if that's the right word. I mean,
say raw.
Yeah. He's not afraid to not cushion it for you at all. Alongside his experiences as a correctional officer, he, like you said, he interweaves this history of the prison for profit system in America. And he starts with the post-Civil War in the South, which is some of the times, and he weaves it in. And he states that this was when white people continued to reinvent ways to cash in on captive human beings. And that's what you're saying, is that idea, that premise never stopped to today.
Yeah, slavery just evolved or adapted to current times. And you know, the provision of the 13th Amendment stipulates that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall be allowed except as a punishment for crime. So most of America doesn't realize slavery actually still exists. Involuntary servitude still exists. Bauer recounts entire prisons filled mostly with African American inmates were rented out to individuals or companies to provide a captive workforce. And inmates were used throughout the South to dig mines, to build railroads, generally working under horrible conditions. We know they built the railroads across America, right? And the death rates were staggeringly high. Convicts, unlike slaves, cost nothing, right? And so that's what we're talking about in terms of devaluing someone's humanity. It's cheaper to use convicts than it was to use slaves. So in a way, America just got more efficient in, you know, profiting off of people. Cash-strapped states and industrious entrepreneurs quickly found out a way to capitalize on labor of incarcerated people.
That just reminded me, I have a degree in history, and I studied the Spanish colonization of the New World. There's a very interesting thing that happened to both groups that are currently affected in Oklahoma, which is African Americans and Natives, where the Creek country in like Georgia and Mississippi, that area was caught between three colonial powers: the Spanish in Florida, the French in Louisiana, and the British in South Carolina. And so they actually, for a period of time, had like a huge amount of power on the geopolitical scale because they were trading in deer skins. And that was like a big deal back in Europe. But then the cotton gin got invented and land became more important than fair exchange. So they were all kicked out to Oklahoma and it was replaced by slave labor to bring in cotton. And you are kind of just seeing that continue where rather than looking for a fair exchange of ideas and cultures and all that, we instead are prioritizing productivity and basically money. Money is causing this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one thing I also found interesting from the book was some of the individuals who profited the most in the 1880s, at least from this, were very prominent Ku Klux Klan members. And so, you know, there is generational wealth created off of selling bodies.
Right. I think Mike and I both in different lenses, but I think Mike and I both are really have been interested in the economics of prisons. I've spent way too much time lately making myself extra depressed about what prison labor looks like and how it impacts, and then the debt that families take on from their loved ones being incarcerated, because we're talking about how they're being used. But this picture is even bigger than that. It's impacting the families who are going into debt. In Oklahoma, 1/3 of families go into debt due to having a loved one incarcerated. And the financial burden of that just stacks. And it goes exactly back to what Evita said about generational wealth. If you are stuck in prison, of course you're not getting generational wealth, but your family is not either. And we're keeping this whole system keeps the same people down. And it's not a flaw. It's the way it was designed. It is completely intentional in the way that it was created.
When we're talking about looking at the generational effect of it, once a parent is taken out of the family and goes to prison, that significantly increases the likelihood of their child actually being incarcerated in the future. And so putting on my teacher cap, you know, when you think about how many children are struggling to read or are experiencing adverse situations because of the instability in the home, because of family imprisonment or wherever it may be, there's a link between third grade reading scores and a prison bed. They anticipate that these children are going to be future money makers.
Exactly. The instructor in the book stated, we want them institutionalized, not individualized. We don't want them to feel as though they are individuals. We want them, for lack of a better term, to feel like a herd of cattle, which if that's not showing you the raw, the blunt, the whatever word fits best that we've been talking about, how this book speaks, I mean, that's it. The profit model of punishment did not die as incarceration rates soared in the 1980s and on. We got the examples of businessmen like T. Don Hutto, who took advantage of overcrowded state prisons and created the new model of private prisons, which has been an increasingly difficult issue for states across the United States. It is usually, from the research that I've done, found that those private prisons have far more egregious, possibly not more frequent, but far more egregious transgressions than a typical in-state run facility.
And since we're talking about inequality, I think even when they do work in prison, they're other than the inequality between those in prison and those not in prison, within the prison itself, there is inequality. I mean, we've all heard about the stark inequality that impacts imprisonment rates. And if you haven't, I suggest you check out our Just Mercy episode for just a small primer. But what happens to inequality after entering the prison system is pretty much unknown. It's a black box. Inequality goes in and inequality comes out, but not much is known about the structures that keep that going while in prison. What we do know is that prisons tend to house those with the least capital, human, financial, and social. And generally, as measured by recidivism rates, prisons have not been successful in addressing those deficits. Research has consistently shown that participating in skilled or vocational work opportunities has positive effects on recidivism and labor market prospects after release. but those skilled or vocational programs are highly sought after and are filled at a disproportionate rate along racial and gender lines. A study at a prison, which was kept anonymous as a condition of entry, found that white inmates made up 35% of the general population, but they were 70% of those working in the call center and 57% of those working as mechanics. Meanwhile, the opposite was true for Black and Latinx inmates, where their general population percentage far outpaced their placement in skilled and vocational job programs. In Oklahoma, the employment contracts between DOC and private telemarketing companies shows that the companies pay DOC $7.25 an hour for each incarcerated employee, but the prison telemarketing program only paid $1.45 an hour. So the industry average on the outside is $11 an hour. You can see the stratification in process. There's inequality between incarcerated individuals and us on the outside, but also between individuals in prison, all of which are underpaid, but some of which, predominantly racial and ethnic minorities, are excluded from the intangible benefits in the form of human capital improvements.
The underpaid aspect of what you just talked about is what gets me super worked up and the part that I think I've gone into the most detail of looking at. Most prisons are run by prisoners, them cooking, cleaning, doing maintenance tasks, as well as many facilities are also run as internal factories, which produce goods, such as a lot of government furniture, even here in Oklahoma, and other labor-intensive products as well. Despite the low pay, the prison industry makes well over $1 billion a year, selling products that inmates make. In fact, 40% of the firefighters that were battling the California outbreak of forest fires are prison inmates, and they were working for actually a little less than $2 an hour. The one that just gets me riled up the most every time is in Oregon. There's a multi-million dollar export of jeans to Italy and Japan that was advertised with the slogan "Prison Blues," made on the inside to be worn on the outside. And a result of these low wages, like I touched on a little bit, was that most incarcerated people rely on finances from their loved ones. A Prison Policy Initiative report in 2017 states families spend billions of dollars each year for the cost of phone calls and commissary purchases. Commissary, what that means under the current system is that incarcerated individuals, they are forced to purchase extra food, clothing, hygiene materials such as soap, and other goods from external vendors who charge lucrative rates for all of their services. And this also then includes phone calls, money transfers, commissary transactions between prisoners as well. A quote that James Baldwin stated was, "Anyone who has ever struggled with poverty knows how extremely expensive it is to be poor." Corporations have now turned the new prison tablets into a predatory scheme. Video calls are $5.95 for 20 minutes, emails 25 cents each, outbound video messaging 75 cents each. There's also music you can buy on these. It's usually about $15 per album, but in some states, this can be up to about $50 for one album. It's about $1.70 to $2.28 per television episode, et cetera, et cetera. This goes on. But there are other expenses outside of commissary and phone calls too. These other expenses include healthcare expenses. For some examples from Oklahoma facilities is that in Bryan County, it's $4 for a medical visit. But in Canadian County or Delaware County, it's $10 and $45 respectively. In Bryan County, it's $15 for an emergency room visit, $40 for shots, $15 for pregnancy tests, $15 for labs, $4 for prescriptions. You can see how these are adding up. In Canadian County, though, it's $10 for a prescription, and it's $10 in Delaware County as well. And then Delaware County has $25 per medical exam. So these finances add up so quickly. Nobody should be shocked by the end of that how one third of Oklahoma families go into debt in Oklahoma supporting their loved ones.
Not only that, the loss of income once a loved one goes into the system, especially if they were the breadwinner. So that further destabilizes the family economically. Our report shows the average Oklahoman family takes home $922.78 a week. These costs on average would make it impossible to sustain an additional $14,000 in a year without taking on additional debt. Many older people are raising the children of their children. Most Oklahoma seniors are on fixed incomes, and 21% of grandparents taking care of their grandchildren are living below the poverty threshold. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the average Social Security income in Oklahoma is $16,583 a year. The median household income for an Oklahoma senior is $33,746. Nationally, it would cost an additional $4 billion each year if the state had to care for all the children currently in grandparent custody. And in 2016, approximately 46,367 grandparents in Oklahoma had the primary responsibility of caring for their grandchildren, all because we insist on separating families instead of seeking other ways to rehabilitate and to treat individuals that are going through crises.
We've touched on this understaffing that we said is happening in a lot of these facilities, but it also means in Oklahoma, these facilities are underfunded in resources for incarcerated individuals. According to Dr. Susan Sharp, about 75% of the women incarcerated by the Oklahoma Department of Corrections have a moderate to high need for substance abuse treatment. And access to these programs is severely limited due to budget constraints. So women often do not receive any treatment or lapse on alcohol and drugs as one of the main reasons for reincarceration. And she even went on to state that it's clear that women in prison in Oklahoma and their children come from disadvantaged backgrounds. Research indicates that even though these mothers may be using drugs, most focus on the well-being of their children. This means that when the mothers go to prison, the child's life is disrupted. And something that we just touched on our previous episode is that when you don't get these resources, when you're thrown back into society after incarceration, you're not ready. You can't take on your full responsibilities of being a caregiver and a mother while also needing the substance abuse treatment that you couldn't get inside the facility and you still are not getting now outside of the facility. And this comes back to this model of where the money's going. And it's not good where it's going. It's not going back to the people of Oklahoma or the incarcerated individuals' families or the incarcerated individuals across the state.
Absolutely. And then also just to piggyback off of what you said, Ashley, in terms of it being difficult to support a family when you get out, it's difficult to find a job that will hire someone that has a criminal conviction. And so if you're making anything or minimum wage, less than minimum wage, how are you supposed to support your family and rebuild that future? And then I also want to touch on the stigma, because people, when they think, oh, prison, they must be bad folks. Well, let's just be honest. Any one of us can have a drug or substance abuse issue. This could be prescription drugs. You go get dental treatment. So this could affect anybody. It's not just this misconception that it's only certain types of people or certain races of people. This can be anyone.
And I know I probably talk about this every podcast, but it's also a cycle where children of incarcerated mothers are 70% more likely to experience adverse childhood experiences, which includes seeing domestic violence in the household or living with someone with mental illness or a substance abuse issue. Those people with a high number of adverse childhood experiences during their own childhood are more likely to go to prison. So you see 59.9% of female prisoners reported experiencing four or more adverse childhood experiences during their own childhood compared to 8.5% of the general population.
Shockingly, I had never heard of ACEs actually before I started working for Oklahomans for Criminal Justice Reform. I heard about it at our first in-person event when we had someone who was getting her master's degree come and speak on it. So my goal is if people listen to Mike and I for long enough, then it will be a common household thing to talk about and know about ACEs, because all of us are huge proponents of the power of knowledge, and just being able to know already sets you up for success and sets the next generations up for success. When we acknowledge the cycle that we're in, we're already through the first step to fixing it.
In the book, the author mentioned the types of books that were allowed. In chapter 13, and he's talking about Louisiana prisons, some of the things that were prohibited, one, 50 Shades of Grey. So he's talking about contemporary times here now. This was not 1950s, books by W.E.B. Du Bois. any Black consciousness books, books that detailed how many people have been hanged or lynched in that area, or, you know, in the country at a, during a certain period. So any of these types of books just were banned. He goes on. It's a long list.
That actually reminds me of the contract between JPay and New York, and they were actually subject to a lot of public scrutiny due to the fact that they were selling incarcerated individuals a handful of state ebooks that were sourced from the Project Gutenberg, which is a database of free books, free for everybody, that they were selling at, I think it was like a 600% rate profit. Even if it hadn't been free, like the profit of the book anyways. But JPay calculated that the profits from associated fees would outweigh the cost of providing the tablets without change. In fact, with roughly 50,000 incarcerated people slated to receive tablets in prisons throughout New York, JPay predicted a net profit of $8.8 million by August of 2022, according to the State Department Corrections. Mike, we know, of course, that the impacted families are pushing for reforms in this area due to their detrimental cost to their life and the life of their loved ones. But are other states working to reform this issue as well?
Yeah, we've seen legislation that opposes this for-profit system in a couple states that have gone through and worked. So Connecticut Senate Bill 972, which was passed in 2021, made prison phone calls free for 90 minutes every day. So in Oklahoma, that would cost a family around $6,000 or $17 a day. So that's saving that amount of money for each of those families. Prior to the passage of that bill, Connecticut families paid nearly $5 for a 15-minute call, which was one of the highest rates in the country. Connecticut made a 68% commission on in-state prison calls through its contract with the phone vendor Securus Technologies, which is one of the nation's largest prison phone vendors. 2019, the state took in around $7 million. So, and also in July of 2018, the New York City Council passed a bill making phone calls from the city's jails free and prohibiting the city from collecting revenues on phone services.
Similarly, as we speak on legislation, we were talking about the environment that all of the people are put in prison facilities, both the correctional officers and the individuals who must live there. And this environment is unfortunately nationwide, and it's led to a shortage of correctional officers in many states, including Oklahoma. So we know that there's legislation in this area as well. Could you fill us in on some of that?
Yeah, definitely. House Bill 3284, which was authored by Representative Justin Humphrey, would lower the minimum hiring range for correctional officers. So the bill proposes lowering Oklahoma DOC's minimum hiring age from 20 to 18. So applicants would be required to have a high school diploma or GED equivalent. And this matters because the Department of Corrections has struggled to hire and retain correctional officers. As of October 31st, there were 471 fully funded correctional officer vacancies that, according to agency budget documents. So the corrections department says lowering the minimum hiring age would allow it to expand recruiting efforts and help alleviate severe understaffing in dozens of correctional facilities. Critics argue that teenagers aren't emotionally prepared to do the sensitive and often dangerous work of supervising prisoners, and the agency should focus on raising pay and improving work conditions.
Yeah, that is a concern. It does depend on the individual, and it also depends on the training. It depends on the administration and how they are keeping their employees accountable. And so hopefully it's not like in the book where there was a public policy and then there was another reality going on inside the prison.
Right. It's hard to believe when we read the horrific things that were happening in these jails, and then pivoting back in Oklahoma, having one of the deadliest prison systems in the nation. The bill felt very, very shocking to me. I can't imagine when I was that age taking on a responsibility like that. And I'm not educated enough on the topic to see how to make a full educated opinion. But are there other states, Mike, that you know of that are doing this similar type of legislation as well?
Yeah, I think one of the main problems is that no one is educated on what putting 18-year-olds into this position would actually do. Neighboring Texas, Kansas, and New Mexico employ correctional officers as young as 18, but most states and the federal government set their minimum hiring age at 21. However, this bill might be putting certain young people at risk at the micro level for little to no benefit at the macro level. For instance, in Florida, they lowered the minimum age of COs from 19 to 18 in 2019, but they have seen no significant increase in applicants or filled positions. And of course, COVID has shaped this entire crisis, but lowering the minimum age is not a guarantee of more applicants or filling those positions. Representative Humphrey has also introduced legislation, House Bill 3307, that would raise the agency's starting salary for correctional officers to $39,200 or around $18.84 an hour. Newly hired correctional officers currently earn $15.74 per hour, which to me, if we are thinking in the purely economic, rational actor sense, is the bigger barrier to getting people to work in the prisons and jails. From a study done by the Prison Journal and Wright State University, is that a higher CO to inmate ratio is correlated with less violence in prisons and jails. So if we want the safest prisons and jails possible for all parties, inmates, COs, administrators, this is an issue that needs to be addressed.
He did mention the high rate of suicide amongst COs. And then he, you know, the book does put on display for us how he changes from someone who thought he had more humanity than he does at a certain point. He began to become crueler and actually enjoy the reactions he was getting from prisoners by being tougher and more harsh on them. So I would think that it's dangerous for anybody, because I think we all think of ourselves more highly than we actually are, or, you know, given the circumstance. All of us are potential, once put in an environment that's so twisted and perverse, to adapt to it. And even more so, someone who is 18 or 19, who, you know, brains aren't fully formed yet. So I think there's multiple things that need to take place in order to address it. And money is one way, but I don't think that's the whole picture. We're talking about the atmosphere within a prison.
I mean, I guess one of the most famous studies is the Stanford Prison Experiment, which
that's the first thing we learn about in our initiation as students. The first thing, they sat us down and they were like, listen.
And that was all college kids, I think. But the guards were found to be increasingly brutal as the experiment went on.
And it was just rapid how fast it happened. It was 5 days from getting this power position to actually resulting to physical and psychological harm to individuals.
Yeah, I guess the main lesson of it was that when people are encouraged by an authority figure, that they're willing to inflict all kinds of damage and pain onto other people. That's potentially what could be happening to 18-year-olds when they're put into prison facilities, because they're encouraged not only by the prison itself, but by the media, by everything that exists in our popular culture, that prisons are dangerous. You need to be ready, and you have the power to make sure that things are safe, whatever that means.
So after the publication of his reporting that he published in Mother Jones, Bauer attends a CCA shareholders meeting, and he finds a mostly unchanged but rebranded company, and questions of low morale, prisoner mistreatment are met with sanctimonious platitudes, which is still something we see today, about public welfare and reducing recidivism. The meeting ends and the activists' questions generate little but a stony, uncomfortable silence. And later, Bauer was invited to Washington to talk to the federal officials studying the efficacy of private prisons. Not long after, the Obama administration announced the Department of Justice would no longer contract with CCA or its ilk. It turned out to be a short-lived mandate, reversed almost immediately by the incoming Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Today, the industry is thriving thanks to a bull market in immigration detention, which, again, is probably something we could do many, many episodes about. Bauer contends that this isn't isolated to Wynn. He writes that multiple government reports have found CCA prisons to be more dangerous and more understaffed than public prisons, which is what we were touching on before. It's not necessarily that there are more incidents in these prisons when you look at the numbers, but the incidents are almost always far more egregious than what we see in other prisons, which are egregious in and of themselves. It's just stacking the worst on top of the already very bad. And with that, I will open everybody up to final thoughts, final words, after such a cheery day today.
My final thought is we need to stop prioritizing the economy over human beings, which is what we talked about with the whole history of the slavery to for-profit prisons and all that. But also paradoxically, they're so focused on generating wealth that it's actually, this kind of mass incarceration is actually hurting the economy of the country and of Oklahoma. It's just a paradox where the only people that are making money really are the private prison companies.
Yeah, exactly. The author calls it a failed experiment. I would say, I think we need to look at what we're doing and then actually look at what we want for our future. What kind of future do we want? Do we want to continue to destabilize our communities, destabilize our entire community and our economy, and to create more harm to people? Or do we want a future that where there is truly less crime, we're not creating more crime, but we're by imprisoning people and destabilizing their families, but where people are treated as humans and you know, we see their humanity. So I think we need to just look at how we are going about what we say rehabilitating people truly. And I think we're smart enough to find a different way than the current way we're doing it. It's unsustainable.
Definitely. My final word and something we can all look out for and we're all going to be oh so very shocked is in January 6th of this year, the 44-year-old founder of prison financial services firm JPay, which we've talked quite a bit about, was charged in federal court on a series of charges, most of them just what we've been talking about, stealing money from individuals, using their insider information to make a profit off the backs of the poorest people in our nation. So I'm sure that that court case will be another very cheery event that we can all look out for and look at. But it's progress. As much as a lot of this is painful to recount, and we've talked about the bluntness, the rawness, all of the things that are coming of it, it's finally coming to light. The more people like us talk about it, the more people get involved, the more that we work towards progress and we work towards a better nation and a better Oklahoma. Oklahoma has continued to reduce their incarceration rates. Any progress is good progress. One of our former employees who still works with us sometimes would always say, you eat an elephant one bite at a time. And that's the best that we can do, but it's a step in the right direction. So with that, we hope that you enjoyed this episode, and we hope to see you back next week.